Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello and greetings from lovely Carlisle Barracks, where it's a toasty September day. Thanks for joining us today on the War Room podcast. This is Jackie Witt. I'm professor of strategy at the U.S. Army War College and the War Room podcast editor. And I'm joined here today with Colonel Buck Haberichter of the United States Air Force.
Hi, Jackie.
And Lieutenant Colonel Josh Kennedy of the United States Army.
Hello, Jackie.
And both of them come from the Special Operations community. And they're joining me here today to discuss, how should we put this, the soft magic or fairy dust or the soft panacea or silver bullet, the allure and the promise that special operations and special operations forces can cure what ails us when it comes to national security and strategy dilemmas. But this is an idea that has some limitations and perhaps even some dangers. At least that's what these two gentlemen are telling me to start. So I'm going to turn it over to Josh for a quick disclaimer right up front.
Yeah, so when we started talking about this topic, the internal concern came up about that there is such a thing as soft magic. So the disclaimer is that no competent soft operator is going to tell you that special operations forces are the panacea or that special operations forces are the only force that the Department of Defense needs. In his May testimony to Congress, the SOCOM commander, General Thomas, even said as much. He said, I think a direct quote is, "SOF is not a panacea, and we are not going to solve the world's problems." A few years ago, we enshrined that into the Special Operations Forces tenets, which one of which is that most special operations require non-SOF support. And so that's just a part of, it's become a part of our culture to not view ourselves that way.
Good. So if, for everybody who's wondering, there's the thesis statement. SOF is not a panacea, not a magic bullet. But let's go back a little bit and talk about why this idea perhaps develops. Where does this idea that SOF can do almost anything come from, do you think?
We've talked about it a little bit. There's the idea, first off, that you know most of special operations goes through some sort of elite selection and assessment program. So you're weeding out those that don't qualify. You're picking out the best of the best in that process. So, you know, obviously to most people who are looking at it from the outside, they would believe that these are, in many cases, some sort of superhero in a lot of cases, and their abilities are abnormally wonderful.
Okay. So there's an elite sort of idea. Are there other sort of mythologies or ideas that, say, the American public or Congress or political leaders have about SOF and what it does and its history?
I think yes. I mean, I think we've seen over time a lot of movies, TV shows that are all designed around SOF. We've got John Wayne, the Green Berets. If John Wayne plays you, then you are really cool. That's just kind of one of the Americanisms, right? But American culture loves that underdog. It loves a small group of highly skilled individuals up against all odds,
right?
That sense of American can-do spirit that they're going to pull through in the end. I think a lot of that gets attached to SOF. And quite frankly, we want that. I think on some level, that's how we get recruits. And we do want those kind of people that are attracted to those kinds of missions. I think certainly politicians see SOF as a... I wouldn't say silver bullet, but they definitely see it as a definitely politically attuned portion of the DOD.
I think that a lot of times when you're talking about politicians, you have to consider the idea of risk and their expectations of our abilities, their expectations of the footprint on the ground, the cost associated with it. The idea of a surgical strike obviously presents a much lower risk in the public eye in many cases. So they see us as the perfect weapon in many cases, not fully understanding what our capabilities and our limitations, more importantly, mm-hmm. are. We were talking a little earlier about the idea of media. Call of Duty, the video game came out years ago, and it started off in the Pacific Theater, I think, and then went to the European Theater and then immediately shifted to SOF. And ever since then, I'm not an expert on this, but I'm pretty sure most of the games they've produced since then that are pretty popular and big sellers have all been around the idea of special operations, small teams, special weapons, right, special tactics, all kinds of things associated with that.
And this goes back a long way to even to the American Revolution, the sort of underdog story, right? Outmanned, outgunned, outfighting, right, that there's a small group of elite right rangers who can solve big, thorny, nasty problems.
And to Josh's point earlier, is there, we as a community have not always done anything to dispel that. Sometimes it's easier to let everyone believe the snake eater myth and that there were, 20-foot tall giants everywhere than it is to delve into the reality and play ourselves down quite a bit.
Right. There's utility to the mythology. It's not absurd or doesn't come out of nowhere.
Right.
Especially to our enemies, right?
Right.
I mean, we want them to think that.
And you want to be a little secretive and to not let them know our capabilities and things like that.
If I can go back for just a minute, when Josh was talking about the idea of the tenets that we follow, they're commonly known as the soft truths. And for those that aren't familiar with them, there were four for many years as we knew them, for those of us that grew up in special operations. And they were: humans are more important than hardware, the idea of relationships and the individual is more important than the equipment they use. Quality is better than quantity. We'd rather have a few, again, to that idea of a few highly qualified men and women rather than legions of them, or legions of people, at least. Special operations forces can't be mass produced. It takes a long time, and a high point for many years was we used to talk quite a bit about the maturity level. The mean age of a special operator was in the mid to late 30s. It's shifted down a bit since then, but you can't produce them very quickly overnight. It takes time. And that speaks to the idea of experience and maturity levels. And then competent special operations forces can't be created after an emergency occurs. So you have to have that special operations base built. It's got to be there in peace and in war. It's not something you can gin up at the last minute, which is probably obvious out of number three. What a lot of folks didn't know for many years was there was actually a fifth soft truth when this all began. And this all began back in 1987. Under Goldwater Nichols, when that was beginning to come out, and the Nunn-Cohen Amendment, there's a guy named John Collins, who was a retired Army colonel. He was not a special operator.
Right.
He came up with these basic imperatives that later transitioned into the soft truths. But the fifth one that Josh mentioned earlier, most special operations requires non-soft assistance, was always there. And somewhere along the way, we in the community, not Josh and myself, but
that's
others,
good to know.
Others kind of dropped that along the way because we kind of started believing a little bit of our own press in terms of the elitism and the idea that we stood alone. And it wasn't until about 2009, I believe, that Admiral Olson, when he took over SOCOM, brought that fifth truth back in because he recognized the utility of we don't stand alone. We operate amongst a general purpose force. We rely on that general purpose force for a great number of things. And the majority of our missions could not be accomplished without some sort of support outside of the SOCOM community.
Good. So it seems like those four truths in some ways fly in the face of maybe the way we traditionally think about U.S. military organizations and structures. So there is something different about SOF, and it has clearly different capabilities, different missions, and even the way SOCOM is formed, right? The political climate in which SOCOM is created and funded is a pretty legendary story, and everybody wants to be SOCOM, right? Cyber Command would love.
Well, that's what they said. They want to be more SOCOM-like.
To be SOCOM. So I think there's a lot of history that's important to understand. Can you talk to me a little bit about what are some of the limitations of SOF? What can't SOF do?
I think initially it's a scope and a size challenge. Like many of those soft truths, I mean, it is a small organization. Although you would think, if you listen to the media, it's much more powerful than it is, maybe, that it's still only 2% of the DoD budget. It's less than 2% of personnel. But it is relied upon to do a lot of strategic level things. But part of the challenge is that it is small. It can only do so much. There are only so many operators to go around the globe. So right now, something like on an average day, there's 8,000 operators deployed in 80 different countries around the globe. That is about that's pushing the capacity quotient. All of the senior soft commanders talk about the operational tempo that we have and the dwell issues, the amount of time that soldiers, sailors, airmen have back at home to prepare for their next mission or even spend time with their families. That's a significant concern to all of the soft commanders.
We are the definition of a low density force. It's just that simple size, the number of airframes we've got of any specific type, the number of people we've got that can operate them, and the fact that we have some of the most highly deployed, highest ops tempo personnel in all of the forces is pretty amazing. And when you consider, I can speak specifically from the vantage point of Air Force Special Operations, we've had squadrons that until just recently had been continuously deployed since Desert Storm. So they had never actually been able to form up at home as a full squadron on any particular occasion up until recent years when they finally brought some of them home. So it's that's one of the biggest problems is just the sheer number. And going back to the idea of what Congress thinks we can do, in the mid-2000s, I happened to be working in the headquarters at Legislative Affairs, and we would constantly get requests for, hey, what would it take to double the size of all special forces? And that would usually come in at about 16:30 on a Friday night. They'd want the answer immediately, and nobody really wanted to answer that question. So it goes back to, you know, it violated the simple soft truths of quality over quantity that we felt we had to hold to. And we knew that if we were going to try and grow the force that rapidly, there would be a sacrifice of quality that we just couldn't stand for. We couldn't double overnight to begin with, because we said we can't produce them. We can't mass produce them overnight. Sure. And oh, by the way, it just doesn't exist in the general purpose force to draw from in the first place. There's an incredible amount of great Americans out there that are serving, but not all of them are qualified to pass the selection and assessment programs of the different special operations units that exist.
And even as that's where we get our recruits from. Mm-hmm. So in most cases, so if the smaller the active duty, or smaller the force gets, not just active duty, but this force in general, the smaller the pool of applicants that we have to pull from.
Yeah, so that SOF doesn't exist in a vacuum outside of other U.S. military structures and organizations and principles. Correct. About who serves and under what terms and what capacities, for how long and where and when. All of those are questions that have to be answered for SOF as well as for our regular and our reserve component forces. So if we talk about the limitations and the size and the time, and I think the soft truths give us a lot about the limitations of soft, what would you say as operators are the things that soft does bring to the table? What's the flip side? What does soft do for say leaders at the strategic level, if we're thinking about sort of the place of the U.S. military in responding to global crises?
I think Special Operations Command provides just what you said, a global perspective. Structure matters, as one of my teaching partners here at the War College says all the time. And SOCOM is organized with theater Special Operations Commands in each geographic combatant command. So that commanding general has a responsibility to support the geographic combatant commander as well as the SOCOM commander. And so there's a network that reaches from the individual operator on the ground all the way back to the SOCOM headquarters through the geographic combatant commanders, and also through SOCOM itself, through the service components of Special Operations Command.
And one of the things we haven't talked about, and for those that aren't familiar, that SOCOM has service-like responsibilities. And there are those that would go as far as to kind of call it almost like a fifth service. And no one's advocating that we separate right now, or not here at least in this discussion. But in that, they've got their own budget that Josh talked about earlier. And to be the fair broker in that there are a lot of things that are provided for Special Operations by their general purpose component. So the weapon that Josh uses on the ground, the M4, the basic M4, is bought by the United States Army and then modified
by SOCOM with what we call MFP 11 dollars. The plane that I fly is provided by the United States Air Force, and then it's modified with MFP 11 dollars. And that's what a lot of people see when they look at SOF. They see the special equipment, and they see the dollars associated with it, the budgets, and they assume that it's all about the toys and it's all about the money that's associated with it. And in fact, what I think one of the things we bring that is not necessarily unique, but it's one of our great strengths. Again, a very intelligent man I worked for many years ago said, "It's not about the money. It's not about the toys. It's not about the special authorities. It's about the habitual human face-to-face relationships." And I think that expertise that SOF has in that we train regularly with one another and we know each other by first name across components. So when I was in the European theater, I knew my Army counterpart by name, and he knew he could count on me, and he knew we had standard operating procedures that we operated under, that we trusted each other implicitly as we operated in battle together and training together. More importantly, because we accomplished the training, we did the same thing in battle together, and we trusted each other in that sense.
And building on that, though, what we bring is an indigenous approach. And so not only are we, Army, Air Force talking to each other on a habitual routine basis, the same is true with partner forces and partner populations. And so there's enduring engagement. Majority of special operating forces are regionally aligned. So they're conducting missions over and over again in the exact same region. Many times, for Army special operators, there's a heavy emphasis on language, to be culturally attuned, to be able to speak a language, to be able to understand an environment, and to have relationships with partner forces is a different aspect that that SOF provides.
Sure. So this is where the sort of bywords of by, with, and through, or the sort of watchwords of one of the SOF principles comes from. So you've sort of said that they embody the joint and the multinational, the partner. So in some ways, I think there's much that can be learned, but at the same time, that SOF is integrated and ingrained within a larger structure of the DoD and within the national security community.
It SOF is unique. I don't want anybody to think that we can take all the lessons from SOF and apply them to the general purpose force and solve all the ills within DoD, because there are some very unique conditions within special operations that exist that couldn't be replicated anywhere else. And that's been suggested before. Secretary Rumsfeld was famous for saying, "I need everyone to be more SOF-like." And there were those that immediately thought, "Well, that's great. I get to grow a beard and untuck my pants, and I get to run around in a strange uniform." Well, that wasn't necessarily what he intended, But yeah, that was a thought process at the time. And I think it's important to say that we're not excluding the Navy here today. We just don't happen to have anyone out of Naval Special Warfare or a MARSOC, for that matter, in the building to come in and talk with us. We consider those obviously equal partners in all this. MARSOC being the most recent addition to Special Operations Command, and we're still growing relationships there, but they've come leaps and bounds in a few short years to be incredible partners in the entire process.
Great. No, we could always use, I think, more naval officers in the building, right?
Yep.
We'll see if they cut that out before broadcast. Anything you want to close with?
I would go as far as to say, Josh brought up General Thomas making the comment in front of Congress recently. It's not new. We have done this for many years, where SOCOM leaders and SOF leaders throughout units spread across the world have all said, "We're not the answer." Very famously, well, when I worked for Admiral Olson years ago in the mid-2000s, we had something called the Egg and Funnel Brief that went around addressing Secretary Rumsfeld's SOF-like comments to get us back to those core capabilities that we knew we were responsible for, we were best at, because at that point we were already being spread too thin with what we'd all call mission creep today. So we have been saying this for quite some time in the community. We think we've been saying it out loud in front of congressional members and those leaders that we answer to. Apparently it's not quite resonating in some cases. And sometimes it's because we have a hard time telling our story, the idea of being quiet professionals. We try and raise our young operators up in that mindset as we come up. They not talk about themselves. And sometimes they do talk about the mission. Unfortunately, we get that gets out. But we do our best to be quiet about what we do. And that adds to that mystique that we talked about in the beginning of this discussion.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the reasons we're here is, you know, quiet professionals does not equal silent professionals. Mm-hmm. And so we do need to get out and tell our story.
Good. Well, thanks for joining me today. Thanks for not being too quiet or silent. It would be a very boring podcast to sit here for 15 or 20 minutes with literally silent professionals. But I thanks for your time, and it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.